The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's issue of Time Magazine is the same as last week's. It's July 20 and 27, 2020. Time Magazine says, "One Last Chance," as its banner headline. Features art by Jill Pelto, and it looks like a various colored layer cake, except the layers are diagonal. And it begins with the sky, which is gray, a layer of earth, which is grayer, an even more gray layer of earth, a yellowish-tan sedimentary layer of earth, then land ice off to the left, and that's blue-white, as if it were one of those large Canadian or Alaskan glaciers. To the right, fir trees, evergreen trees, thick as pile on a carpet, renewable energy consumption, and finally at sea level. It looks like chunks of the glacier, of the land ice, are floating in this blue sea. At sea level. Beginning Time Magazine today with The View Essays, subtitled Community, by Belinda Luscom. We think we gave our neighbor COVID-19. A few days before our longtime next-door neighbor moved out of his New York City loft in late March, he texted us and asked if we would look after his fish and some plants, since he could not move into his new place for a while. "Sure," we texted back. "It's not like we're going anywhere." Our history of looking after things is spotty, but he needed a hand, and I thought it might be time to skill up. His home and ours have only ever been separated by a semi-permeable membrane anyway. We share a common outdoor space. We have each other's spare keys, use each other's appliances, have permission to just go in and borrow anything when the other's away. When we had young kids in the home, we hosted big pancake breakfasts. As they got older, we would let each other know when we could smell them smoking pot. We had a standing invitation to his dinner parties. So he brought over his fish and plants and borrowed our ladder. He was masked because of the movers. We were not, because we were just lolling about. It was pure luck we were even dressed. It was a quick handover. We did not touch. 2 days later, we came down with COVID-19 symptoms. It was bad, especially for my spouse. 2 weeks later, our neighbor texted to say he thought he had it too. He has a baby, a wife, an elderly mother who was living nearby. When I read on her social media page a week or so later he was in the hospital with pneumonia, my stomach began to churn. We were not sure we were the ones who gave it to him, neither was he, for the record, but the possibility was horrifying. The self-recriminations were legion and grim. Why were we not more careful? How is it that we, who were fully aware of the dangers of the virus, the measures one was supposed to take to keep it in check, and his family situation, still acted in a way that meant he could get infected? What if he died? Having had the virus, I knew that people who check in too often can be a burden, but I occasionally texted his wife, warily monitored his mother's updates for any change in tone, and sent him tips on things we did that helped. While he was in the hospital, I texted photos of the flourishing plants on his side of the deck to cheer him up. My husband did some moving house-type favors. I changed the aquarium water a lot. We were determined to prove we were responsible human beings. Even so, a couple of times a day, I'd have a sudden spike of anxiety and guilt as I remembered his situation. It is very hard to imagine being contagious when you do not feel sick, especially in familiar situations like when you are in your own home or with good friends. This is this virus's most deadly aspect. It is spreading before its carriers even know they have it. It's the termite of diseases. By the time you put your foot through the floorboard, it is too late. That is difficult to get used to. Mistakes will be made. We should have put on masks. We should have wiped down the ladder. We should have declined the fish. Discarded aquariums and plants are a run-of-the-mill moving story. The demise of a prominent sociologist because of his neighbor's carelessness is a tragedy. Acts that normally feel like the right thing to do, a favor for a friend, the celebration of a birthday or wedding, can turn out to be very wrong. So as I watch people emerging from their isolation and gravitating toward one another at parties and beaches, I want to hire a plane to fly with a banner saying, "If you like those people, stand back a bit." Nobody's going out of their way to infect others, but the damn thing about this virus is people have to go out of their way not to infect others. As communal beings, we are drawn to each other. And as communal beings, we need to avoid each other for that very same other's sake. But I also want to fly a banner over the homes of those who are staying in and judging those who slip up. This one would say, "Humans, still only human." Part of looking out for each other's understanding, well-intentioned people make mistakes, and those mistakes are not more idiotic often than yours. This much we know about the virus. It is serious, contagious, and in more than 132,000 cases so far in America, fatal. That is dangerous enough without its tearing communities apart, too. My neighbor survived. The fish didn't. Too many water changes. We are still friends. Next, under the subtitle, Family. No Joy Without Singing, by Tom Vanderbilt. A few years ago, I began taking vocal lessons. Like many people, I was an enthusiastic, lifelong singer, at least in the privacy of my shower. But I wondered if I could actually acquire any skill in the discipline, enough that my family would stop flinching as I belted out the occasional tune around the house. As with any motor skill, what singing primarily is, it took a lot of work. But gradually I began staying more on pitch, expanding my range, improving my breath control. I soon felt the need to do something with this singing, as I was hardly ready for a solo recital at Carnegie Hall. I decided to join a choir. I signed up with a group called the New York Choir Project, largely on the strength of two things. First, they did songs by Oasis and Eminem. Second, and more important, they did not require auditions. Even so, the early days were terrifying. I probably lip-synced half the time, taking shelter in the sonic envelope of my fellow choristers. But a funny thing happened. Choir became a high point in my life. I'd close out normally dreary Mondays with that evening's rehearsal and leave on an absolute high. Small wonder, for as science and experience have shown, singing together is ridiculously good for us. There is a raft of evidence for how it improves our sense of well-being, releases a flood of beneficial hormones, lowers blood pressure, and boosts immune response. The choir brought things to my life I was not even aware I was missing. New friends, a reassuring ritual, the challenge of doing something novel. But then a not-so-funny thing happened, COVID-19. In early March, we were rehearsing energetically for a show. By the next week, the rehearsals and the show were history. Later, news would emerge of how a choir rehearsal in Washington State was a super spreader event that infected dozens and left two choir members dead. In an operatic twist of tragic irony, this thing was so good for people that was so good for people was now an epidemiologist's nightmare. Imagine a warm room filled with recycled air, packed with people, The ideal distance between singers has been put at 18 to 24 inches, but often we were literally rubbing shoulders, potentially emitting 6 times the percentage of airborne droplet nuclei as a roomful of people merely talking would. A dynamic engine for producing transcendent sound was now a virulent conduit for spreading pathogens. As the spring weeks wore on, deprived of my voice, I turned to Smule, S-M-U-L-E, the popular karaoke app. It goes like this. Use your phone and earbuds and sing either one half of a song or join someone else's pre-recorded track. As in a kind of Facebook in song, come find me at the handle Adult Beginner. You friend people, you favorite, you leave comments. Singing into your phone with strangers may seem odd, but curiously enough, the old power of music to connect people can still come through. Smule says there are hundreds of Smule babies it knows of. The children of people who met through the app and started families. I am not looking for love, but I have sung Sondheim with Indonesians and REM with Floridians. I've sung Spanish ballads with Germans and reggae anthems with Koreans. I've sung with people in their parked cars or in their bedrooms. I've made new singing buddies around the globe. There's nothing like opening up via the vulnerable act of singing to find out if you strike a chord with someone. But I miss my real world choir. I miss feeling the actual energy coming off other people. I miss having an audience beyond my wife and daughter. Like any number of quarantined choirs, and choral singing is America's most popular performing art by participation, my choir has moved online to the familiar Zoom grid. It is reassuring to see this sea of earbud-clad friendly faces, but as the technology is not quite there, we cannot all sing together live. I'm dreaming of the day our voices and breath reunite. Vanderbilt, who authored this article, is the author of Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning, out in January. The View, 7 questions. And this was compiled by Eben Shapiro with reporting by Alice Park. Pfizer, P-F-I-Z-E-R, CEO Albert Bourla, B-O-U-R-L-A, is raising expectations that the pharma giant will deliver a COVID-19 vaccine this fall. Pfizer is increasingly confident its efforts to develop a coronavirus vaccine will be successful. In July 7 interview with Time, Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said he believes the Food and Drug Administration approval could come as soon as October. On the basis of promising results in an early-stage trial released July 1, Pfizer has dramatically increased the projections for the number of doses it will produce this year to 100 million. Bourla also disclosed the company's begun commercial talks with governments around the world about how many doses they'll receive. Bourla is so convinced his global pharmaceutical giant is on the right track, he has decided Pfizer will start producing the vaccine before receiving approval from the FDA. It is a move as risky as it is unorthodox. Pfizer's vaccine, being developed with its German biotech partner, BioNTech, uses a novel genetics-based approach called messenger RNA. Bourla acknowledges no messenger RNA vaccines has ever been approved to prevent infectious disease to date. Pfizer is set to launch a large-scale clinical trial later this month, which will involve 30,000 people at 150 locations by the end of the test period. Bourla, 58, who was born in Greece and trained to be a veterinarian before working his way up the ranks at Pfizer, plans to price the vaccine to make a profit, but believes government should distribute the first doses to the most vulnerable at no cost. This is the question. What did the data that Pfizer and BioNTech released on July 1 show? Answer, that the vaccine in humans created the very robust immune responses in all individuals that received the vaccine, and those responses were also able to kill the virus. What we learned is that this vaccine can neutralize the virus. Question, so it was a big moment? Answer, for me it was the moment when I saw the data, plus many other data that we have not published yet, that made me say that until now I was thinking, if we have a vaccine, now I'm discussing when we are going to have a vaccine. Let's talk timing. You said your reaction was not if but when, so when? Answer, well, let me be accurate and factual here. One, we will only know if the vaccine works when we have the final study. We have a lot of indications that make me feel it really should make it. We should be able in the September time frame to have enough data to say if the vaccine works or not, and to submit that to the FDA. So for a potential approval in October, if we are lucky, it is feasible. And when will it be ready to be distributed? Answer, the most interesting and important thing is that if the vaccine is successful, which means if we're convinced about it, effective and safe, and the FDA is convinced about it, effective and safe, we will have already manufactured doses that will be readily available. So have you ever done that before, started manufacturing pre-FDA approval to get it ready to ship? Answer, no, never. Are you currently manufacturing the possible vaccine itself, or just the bottles and containers it will go in? Answer, pretty soon we will start manufacturing actual vaccine. We may not bottle it yet because we are waiting, but there are a lot of stages. You have invested more than $1 billion in this. What if the FDA rejects the vaccine? Answer, we will just have to write it off and call it a day. We will throw it away. It is only money we're going to lose. The next article is headlined Climate. Standing at a Climate Crossroads by Justin Warland. It's accompanied by an illustration by Chris Dent. Up at the top left-hand corner, there's a pinkish-reddish blob thing. One might think it's an alien spacecraft, but based upon illustrations seen on television and in other publications, it looks to me like a replication of what we're to believe is the coronavirus. Of course, it's been expanded many, many times. But on the lower part of the page is a depiction of several ice flows. And they're kind of meandering through a gray sea. And they depict famous landmarks in various cities of the world. One appears to be London because it has the London Eye, the big Ferris wheel, and the bridge. I don't know its name, but it's one of the famous bridges with little towers on it. And the egg-shaped, dome-like building, I believe that's considered the financial district of London. And then other ice flows show palm trees, and another one shows the Eiffel Tower with more shorter buildings near it. Then there's a big satellite, it looks like a big TV satellite. It could be the Space Dome at in Seattle. Then there's the Kremlin. It's colored in pinks and purples, the Kremlin of Moscow. There's a big cathedral-looking building in another corner of the ice flow congregate, and I don't recognize any of the other buildings surrounding it, so I don't know if that's supposed to be in Washington, D.C., or some other cathedral-prone city. And there's one more that's just about off the page, and it features kind of a pinkish-looking duodomed tower. One of the domes or spheres is really near the ground, and the other is at the top of the tower. And again, I do not know which city that is supposed to depict. But this is entitled Standing at a Climate Crossroads, the Defining Year. The world was ready to tackle climate change. Then 2020 happened. Here's another photograph, and this is by Trent Park. Well, the previous thing that I described was an illustration. This is a photograph, and it looks like it's nebulous. It's clouds, but in various colors of the rainbow, blue and violet and pink and red and purple and orange and yellow. I do not see any green. I do see dark shades that are either very dark gray or blue-gray or black. It's the sunrise over a power station in Adelaide, Australia in 2019. City skies across the world have been clearer during the COVID-19 pandemic, but that is unlikely to last. From our vantage point today, 2020, looks like the year when an unknown virus spun out of control, killed hundreds of thousands, and altered the way we live day to day. In the future, we may look back at 2020 as the year we decided to keep driving off the climate cliff or to take the last exit. Taking the threat seriously would mean using the opportunity presented by this crisis to spend on solar panels and wind farms, push companies being bailed out to cut emissions and foster greener forms of transport in cities. If we instead choose to fund new coal-fired power plants and oil wells and thoughtlessly fire up factories to urge growth, we will lock in a pathway toward climate catastrophe. There is a divide about which way to go. Sounds like Robert Frost. In early April, as COVID-19 spread across the U.S. and doctors urgently warned New York City might soon run out of ventilators and hospital beds, President Donald Trump gathered CEOs from some of the country's biggest oil and gas companies for a closed-door meeting in the White House Cabinet Room. The industry faced its biggest disruption in decades, and Trump wanted to help the companies secure their place at the center of the 21st century American economy. Everything was on the table, from a tariff on imports to the U.S. government itself purchasing excess oil. "We will work this out, and we will get our energy business back," Trump told the CEOs. "I am with you, 1,000%. A few days later, he announced he brokered a deal with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to cut oil production and rescue the industry. Later in April, Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, in a video message from across the Atlantic, offered a different approach for the continent's economic future. A European Green Deal, she said, would be the EU's motor for the recovery. "We can turn the crisis of this pandemic into an opportunity to rebuild our economies differently," she said. May 27, she pledged more than $800 billion to the initiative, promising to transform the way Europeans live. For the past 3 years, the world outside the U.S. has largely tried to ignore Trump's retrograde position on climate, hoping 2020 would usher in a new president with a new position, re-enabling the cooperation between nations needed to prevent the worst ravages of climate change. But there is no more time to wait. We are standing at a climate crossroads. The world has already warmed 1.1 centigrade degrees since the Industrial Revolution. If we pass 2 degrees centigrade, we risk hitting one or more major tipping points where the effects of climate change go from advancing gradually to changing dramatically overnight, reshaping the planet. To ensure we do not pass that threshold, we need to cut emissions in half by 2030. Climate change has understandably fallen out of the public eye this year as the coronavirus pandemic rages. Nevertheless, this year, or perhaps this year and next, is likely to be the most pivotal yet in the fight against climate change. We have run out of time to build new things in old ways, says Rob Jackson, an earth science professor at Stanford University. Jackson's also chair of Global Carbon Project. What we do now will define the fate of the planet and human life on it for decades. The time frame for effective climate action was always going to be tight, but the coronavirus pandemic shrunk it further. Scientists and policymakers expected the green transition to occur over the next decade, but the pandemic's pushed 10 years of anticipated investment in everything from power plants to roads into a months-long time frame. Countries have already spent $11 trillion to help stem the economic damage from COVID-19. They could spend trillions more. It is in this next 6 months that recovery strategies are likely to be formulated and the path is set, says Nicholas Stern, a former World Bank chief economist, known for his landmark 2006 report warning climate change could devastate the global economy. We do not know where the chips will fall. Will a newfound respect for science and a fear of future shocks lead us to finally wake up? Or will the desire to return to normal overshadow the threats lurking just around the corner? We find ourselves on the brink of climate catastrophe in large part because of the decisions made during a past crisis. As the world came out of the Great Depression and World War II, the U.S. launched a rapid bid to remake the global economy running on fossil fuels. In the first post-war years, Americans moved to suburbs and began driving gas-guzzling cars to work, while the federal government built a highway system to connect the country for those vehicles. The single biggest line item in the Marshall Plan, the U.S. government program that funded the European recovery, went to support oil, which ensured the continent's economy would also run on that fossil fuel. Meanwhile, plastic, an oil derivative, became the go-to building block for consumer goods after the U.S. had developed production capacity for use in World War II. The underlying philosophy of economic development in this time period was a focus on gross national product, a term developed by U.S. government economists during the Depression, which included consumption as a proxy for prosperity. The more we consume, the better off we are, according to this model, which in the post-war era the U.S. assiduously spread abroad. The promise of endless growth also required an endless supply of oil to power factories, automobiles, and jet planes. In 1945, President Franklin D. Roosevelt sealed a deal with Ibn Saud, the first king of Saudi Arabia, trading security for access to the country's vast oil reserves. Every U.S. president since, implicitly or explicitly, has continued that exchange. The coronavirus pandemic is the most significant disruption yet to the post-war fossil fuel order. The global economy is expected to contract more than 5% this year, according to the International Monetary Fund, IMF. This is a challenge so big, it's also created a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to change direction. This moment comes just in time. In 2018, a landmark report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN's climate science body, warned that allowing the planet to warm any more than 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels would drive hundreds of millions of people into poverty, destroy coral reefs, and leave some countries unable to adapt. A 2019 analysis in the journal Nature identified 9 tipping points, from the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet to the thawing of Arctic permafrost, that the planet appears close to reaching, any one of which might very well be triggered if warming exceeds 1.5 degrees centigrade. Going beyond 2 degrees centigrade is a very critical step, says Johan Rockström, director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, not only in terms of economic and human impact, but also in terms of the stability of the Earth. To keep temperatures from rising past the 1.5 centigrade goal, we would need to cut global greenhouse gas emissions 7.6% every year for the next decade, according to a report from the UN Environment Programme, UNEP. That's about the level of the COVID-19 pandemic will reduce emissions this year. But virtually no one thinks a deadly pandemic and accompanying unemployment is a sustainable way to halt climate change. And recessions are typically followed by sharp rebounds in emissions. To achieve the 1.5 centigrade goal without creating mass disruption has always meant thoughtfully restructuring the global economy, moving it away from fossil fuel extraction slowly but surely. Scientists and economists agree this is the last opportunity we have to do so. If we delay further than 2020, says Rockström, there's absolutely no empirical evidence that it can be done in an orderly way. External pressure is likely to force the issue, and the EU is trying to offer just that. To push China and others along, the bloc, BLOC, is crafting a new tax on imports from countries that are not reducing emissions. Climate and trade are both currently being discussed by officials behind the scenes and were planned to be on the top of the agenda at a now postponed September summit between the EU and China. Europe is a very important market for the Chinese, says Lawrence Tubiana, the CEO of the European Climate Foundation and a key architect of the Paris Agreement. China can be secured in its potential exports to Europe by understanding it can secure positive trade relations by increasing its climate ambition. Still, when it comes to turning the climate ship around, there is no substitute for the U.S., and the country's already missed opportunities. For example, before doling out bailout money, France demanded that Air France stop operating emissions-intensive short routes, and Austria forced Austrian Airlines to agree to cut its emissions 30% by 2030. Contrast that with the U.S., where the government decreed that to receive federal dollars, airlines could not drop any of their destinations, even if that meant flying planes empty. And Congress rejected an attempt from several Democratic senators to attach green strings to the airline bailout. It is hard to imagine anything substantive so long as Trump is president. He and his GOP allies in Congress have an effective stranglehold on any policy that could push the U.S. to decarbonize. And thus far, they've rejected big legislation to address climate change, portraying it as socialist and part of the Green New Deal that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party proposed last year to the derision of Republicans. Instead, the Trump administration's reportedly preparing a $1 trillion infrastructure package focused on roads and bridges. If we label it green, that would actually probably decrease its chances of being included, said a Democratic congressional aide who works on energy and climate. So the future of U.S. emissions will likely fall to the winner in the fall. Joe Biden, former vice president and presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, is well aware of the role the pandemic recovery will play in shaping emissions. Biden oversaw the last U.S. stimulus a decade ago in the midst of the Great Recession. That package totaled nearly $800 billion, with $90 billion for clean energy measures, and helped launch many of America's green advances, including funding Tesla's transformation from a boutique car company to the world's most valuable auto manufacturer, funding a program that doubled the fuel efficiency of Daimler Truck's Freightliner model, supporting the weatherization of more than a million homes to reduce residential energy consumption. That package created 900,000 jobs and turned a profit for the government, even as it suffered high-profile failures like the collapse of the Solyndra solar panel company. Climate concerns are at the center of economies and the center of development plans. This cannot be the purview of even 25,000 or 40,000 or 100,000 people, says Cristiana Figueres, who led the UN climate change body during the Paris climate talks. This has got to permeate through every single corner, every single channel, every single flow of economic development and modernization. It has got to become the new norm. That will come one way or another. Every country will be combating climate change for the foreseeable future. The change in climate we are experiencing today is in large part the result of emissions that happened more than a decade ago. However, we do have a choice of how bad it will get. If we invest in preserving nature and transitioning our energy system today, we will stave off the worst, giving us the ability to manage the hurricanes and floods as they come. If we wait, we will be stuck, flat-footed, when the worst arrives, watching in dismay as the temperature curve ticks up and up. The choice is ours. We just don't have much time to decide. That lengthy article was abridged, and here is a photograph. It's taken from a bird's eye view, and I see a grid as if it were in a city situation with blocks and streets and intersections and crossroads here and there. And on top of it all is something that looks like a ball of yarn has fallen out of a basket and splayed everywhere. It is one of Los Angeles' most crowded highway interchanges, and it was nearly empty. Rush hour, April 24. Multiple lanes of traffic on the main up and down or north and south grid. At least 12 lanes of traffic with about 12 cars visible from the bird's eye view. Here's a shorter complimentary article entitled Viewpoint: Take Climate Action at the Ballot Box by Stacey Abrams. And Abrams is the former Georgia House Democratic leader and the author of Our Time Is Now and the founder of Fair Fight and the Southern Economic Advancement Project. Halfway into the year, our nation has reached a precipice, a criminal justice system infected by racism that continues to take black lives, avoidable deaths that keep climbing as COVID-19 sprawls, the scourge of voter suppression, an economy that's left millions of Americans wondering how they will survive. Teetering on the edge in the midst of this tumult, a familiar peril still looms. Inaction on climate change threatens the future. I understand the impulse to divert our attention toward seemingly more immediate challenges, but extreme weather continues. Natural disasters are intensifying. Polar ice is still melting. Sea levels are rising. The human cost remains stubbornly high. The reckonings felt by those who struggle to breathe as carbon dioxide levels reach their highest point in 800,000 years, and those who cannot afford their utility bills, given that 19 of the 20 warmest years on record have occurred since 2001. And as with the public health crisis, police brutality, and economic collapse, communities of color will suffer the disproportionate impacts of climate change. Our obligation to confront this catastrophe has not changed. To continue on our current trajectory without aggressive action will doom millions. But what's changed is the calculus the environmental movement ought to make. The work to make advanced energy policy a reality and to actuate climate mitigation efforts requires engaging a diverse array of voices. The most effective climate action coalition will center discussions about how delay will affect their neighborhoods and daily lives. Only then can we build alliances to overwhelm the system with our votes. Climate change may be one of the greatest threats to our democracy, but the right to vote is our most powerful tool to defeat it. We can no longer simply appeal to the hearts and minds of our elected leaders. Climate actors must work to strip the skeptics of their power. Change comes when those in authority risk being swept away. It becomes permanent when we elect climate warriors up and down the ballot. If our vote did not count, the forces trying to take it away would not be so desperate, throwing up roadblocks through voter roll purges, racially discriminatory voter identification laws, and 5 to 6 hour lines to vote. We know the power voting has on national efforts to tackle climate change. Voting brought us to the table as President Obama signed on to the Paris Agreement. Then not voting devastated our progress as President Trump, whose election was decided by fewer than 80,000 votes across 3 states, abandoned the accord. In 2020, the choice is ours once again. When we commit to stewardship of our resources on behalf of all communities, we carve out more time for future generations. Let us be ruthless in our righteousness and boundless in our boldness in the fight for climate justice, because when we fight, we win. Under climate and business, can big agriculture ever go green? By Emily Barone. April 12, a meat processing plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, owned by Smithfield Foods, shut down after hundreds of employees contracted coronavirus. The closure was hardly unique. Food processing plants are tinderboxes for infection because employees work in close proximity and often need to shout, spraying droplets that can be laced with the virus. Cargill, Tyson, and other major industry players closed about 24 poultry, pork, and beef processing centers over the following weeks as workers fell ill. In April and May, more than 17,000 industry workers tested positive for COVID-19, and 91 died, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The impact rippled to grocers who struggled to stock certain items and to restaurants like Wendy's, which temporarily changed its menu at some locations to compensate for beef shortages. At the same time, farmers were forced to kill animals that could not be slaughtered. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, estimates beef and pork production in April was down 20% and 10% respectively, compared with a year earlier. Processing plants emit carbon dioxide, and when their operations slow down, so do emissions. But the real climate benefit from slowing the agriculture industry is reducing the methane from livestock and nitrous oxide from treating fields with fertilizers. When you add it all up, about 10% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions come from the agriculture industry. Americans too often don't think about where the milk or ground beef in the shopping carts originated, let alone the carbon footprint of those products. That is because the U.S. food system is so robust that shortages or price spikes two conditions that might trigger consumers to take a closer look at the supply chain are rare. The pandemic might be an exception, but even that, experts say, is not likely to have a lasting impact. COVID-19 has slowed us down a little bit and forces us to think about some of these things, says Tang Lim, an associate professor at University of Missouri's Commercial Agriculture Program. But when we get back to what we do normally, we forget how things were before. Meat processing has already started to recover since April, and consumers are ready to buy. In June, the USDA forecasts that not only will red meat and poultry production bounce back from the coronavirus dip, it'll keep growing and hit a record 107 billion pounds in 2021. It is not unusual for farmers to get 10 cents on a chicken that sells for $6 at the supermarket, or around $10 for a whole pig that takes 6 months to raise. Given such slim margins, it's easy to see why the industry is fixated on efficiency and economies of scale. There are fewer meat packers now compared with decades ago, and the plants operating today are much larger. Farms have dramatically consolidated as well. A 2017 USDA census found just 4% of all farms control 58% of farm land. To boost margins, farms and processors have streamlined and specialized operations in every way possible in recent decades. They use techniques that yield more for each animal, ranging from vaccinating the animals and improving their feed to more controversial practices like breeding animals to be larger, packing them into confined spaces, and slaughtering them inhumanely. For example, in 1950, there were 25 million dairy cows in the U.S. Today, there are 9 million, but they produce 60% more milk. Such efficiency improves the farmer's bottom line and lowers the emissions per glass of milk. However, farm emissions overall continue to rise, in part because today's larger animals eat more. In the case of cattle and dairy cows, that means more belching and more cow pies, two major sources of methane gas. We have optimized our efficiencies, says Frank Mittlaner, professor in the Animal Science Department at the University of California, Davis. This has benefits, but it's also a problem. We have very few processing plants, and if one or two have a problem, it runs through the whole supply chain. It is very painful to watch. With foundations like these, the system was bound to wobble when the pandemic hit. So far, it's mostly held up to the pandemic. But as the number of COVID-19 cases continues to rise in the U.S., there's no certainty it'll do so forever. Arguably, what makes the agriculture industry vulnerable in a pandemic is also what puts it in a good position to tackle emissions. Larger farms are more suited to comply with government regulations, and the more land and livestock under their control, the greater the impact their actions have. But so far, there hasn't been nearly enough progress. Methane's distinctly different from other greenhouse gases. It's about 25 times better at trapping and emitting heat than CO2. But animal-produced methane is part of a natural cycle, unlike CO2, from fossil fuels, which rides a one-way street from beneath the Earth's surface to the atmosphere. After it's belched out of the cow, methane breaks down after about 10 years. CO2, on the other hand, sticks around for centuries. Even so, reducing methane emissions is important to the globally agreed-to goals to keep planetary warming well below 2 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. The best way to eliminate agricultural methane emissions would be to stop farming cows. But dietary patterns change slowly, and in the interim, the U.S. farming industry is working on ways to limit methane emissions while still providing the public the meat products it expects. The industry is poised to apply science that can both improve the health of livestock and reduce their emissions, says Sarah Place, Chief Sustainability Officer at animal health giant Elanco. That's E-L-A-N-C-O. For example, U.S. farms are increasingly adopting technologies that capture methane that comes off pounds of cow poop. The method, already widely used in Canada and Europe, involves capping the ponds with a liner to trap the gas, which then gets piped to a facility called a digester system several miles away, where it's converted into biogas. That can be used as fuel to run delivery trucks. To combat emissions from the other end of the cow, feed additives like seaweed that inhibit the methane-producing enzymes in the cow's digestive system may do the trick. Other additives have been shown in trials to change the fermentation process in the cow's digestive tract so that the cow burps up hydrogen, a harmless gas, instead of methane. There's also ongoing research in genetics. If cows can be bred to produce more meat or milk, it might also be possible to breed them to emit less methane. Some industry research and consultants like Place and Mittlaner are excited about these technologies, but there are plenty of critics. Rather than continually engineer our way out of problems with animals, there's a simple solution. Eat more plants, says Josh Balk, Vice President of Farm Animal Protection at the Humane Society of the U.S. Balk does not think the country can rely on consumers to make such a massive dietary shift. Instead, he says the food industry can help elevate plant-based foods by selling them alongside animal products in grocery stores and offering them as menu items, as White Castle, Burger King, and other restaurant chains have started to do, with plant-based meat alternatives. Overall, the agriculture industry has a major stake in lowering emissions. If emissions continue to rise, plants bred and crossbred over decades to optimize the food system may not withstand rising global temperatures. Industry changes that address both emissions and the welfare of animals may also reduce the risk of the next pandemic. COVID-19 did not start at farms, but animals packed into confined spaces can easily spread infection. Poultry, for example, has been known to make people sick with avian flu. There is no one point in the food system solely responsible for making the necessary changes. At the end of the day, we all have to eat, and consumers, processors, distributors, and producers alike have a role in ensuring that food is available to all and produced in a way that is sustainable for the planet and humanity. And here's another short article under Viewpoint. We must act as one to preserve our world, by the Dalai Lama, who is spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhists and a Nobel laureate. This essay is adapted from his recent Time 100 talk. The planet is our only home. Environmental experts say over the next few decades, global warming will reach such a level that many water resources will go dry. So ecology and combating global warming are very important. For example, my country, Tibet, is the ultimate source of water in Asia. Rivers including Pakistan's Indus, India's Ganges, and Brahmaputra, China's Yellow River, as well as the Mekong flow from Tibet's plateau. So we should pay more attention to the preservation of Tibetan ecology. This is not only for the interest of 6 million Tibetans, but all people in this region. In the past, when I was flying over Afghanistan, there were clear signs that what used to be lakes and streams were already dry. I feel Tibet also may become like that soon. Regarding Tibet's political matters, I have already retired. But regarding Tibet's ecology and very rich culture, I'm fully committed. We human beings have these marvelous, brilliant minds, but we're also the biggest troublemakers on the planet. Now we should utilize our brains with compassion and a sense of concern. This is why one of my commitments is promotion of deeper human values. From birth, we rely on others, particularly our mothers. From then, each individual's existence entirely depends on a community, because we are a social animal. Community is the source of our happiness, so we must take care of the community. So now in modern times, the concept of humanity is one community, east, west, north, south. Everyone's interdependent. The modern economy has no national boundaries. Therefore, now we need a sense of oneness of all 7 billion human beings. In the past, many problems were created because of too much emphasis on our differences, such as nationalities and religions. Now, in modern times, that thinking's out of date. We should think about humanity, the whole world. We must listen to scientists and specialists. Their voices and knowledge are very important. And religious people should pay more attention to scientists rather than pray, pray, pray. In the ancient Nalanda Buddhist tradition, which we Tibetans follow, everything's investigated and not accepted by faith alone. If through reasoning we find some contradiction, even in Buddha's own words, then we have the right to reject them. From childhood, I was always engaged in a lot of debate. Our thinking was based not in faith, but reasoning. Hours, minutes, seconds, time never stands still. We also are part of that nature. The past is important, but already past. The future is still in our hands. So we must think about ecology at the global level. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.